Chapter 28. March 19th, 12:02 p.m. Cape Town, South Africa. As Tucker set foot off the plane's stairway and onto the hot tarmac of Cape Town's International Airport, a shout rose ahead. They had landed at a private terminal, shuttled here by corporate jet, a Gulfstream 5, arranged by Harper.
"Mr. Wayne, sir, over here."
He turned to see a tall, thin black man in his mid-20s trotting toward him. He wore charcoal slacks and a starched white shirt. He gave Tucker a broad smile and stuck out his hand.
"Mr. Tucker Wayne, I presume?"
He took the man's hand.
"And you are?"
"Christopher Nkomo."
Kane came trotting down behind him, sliding next to Tucker, sniffing at the stranger, sizing him up.
"My goodness," the man said. "Who is this fine animal?"
"That would be Kane."
"He's magnificent."
No argument there. Bukalov and Anya came next, shielding their eyes as they joined him. Introductions were made all around.
"What tribe are you?"
Anya asked, then blurted out.
"Oh, is that impolite to ask? I'm sorry."
"Not at all, Mrs. I am of the Ndebele tribe."
"And your language?"
"We speak Xhosa."
He waved and guided them across the tarmac toward a nest of parked Cessnas and other smaller aircraft.
"But I went to university here, studying business administration and English."
"It shows," said Tucker.
"Very kind of you."
He finally stopped before a single-engine plane, a Cessna Grand Caravan. It was already being serviced for flight.
"With your patience, we will get all your baggage loaded quickly."
Christopher was a man of his word. It was accomplished in a matter of minutes.
"Your pilot will be with you shortly," he said,
clambering up the short ladder and through the Cessna's side door. A moment later, he hopped back out, his head now adorned with a blue pilot's cap.
"Welcome aboard. My name is Christopher Nkomo, and I will be your pilot today."
Tucker matched his grin.
"You'll be flying us?"
"Myself and my older brother Matthew."
A thin arm stuck out from the side window next to the co-pilot's seat.
"No worries," Christopher said. "I am a very good pilot, and I know this land and its history like the palm of my hand."
"I hear you are all Boer historians, and that I am to assist you however I can."
From the tone of the man's voice, he knew they weren't historians. Harper clearly must have debriefed Christopher about the goal of their mission here.
"I am especially familiar with Springbok. My cousin has a home there. So, if we are all ready, let us get aboard."
Bukalov and Anya needed no coaxing to climb out of the sun and into the dark, air-conditioned interior. Bukalov took the seat farthest from Anya. The doctor was not happy to have her along, but back in Istanbul, Tucker had left him no choice. Tucker hung back with Christopher.
"The supplies I asked for?"
"Come see."
Christopher lifted a hatch to reveal a storage space neatly packed with supplies. He pulled out a clipboard and handed it to Tucker. It listed the contents: potable water, dehydrated meals, first aid kits, maps and compasses, knives, hatchets, a small but well-stocked toolbox.
"As for weapons and ammunition," the man said, "I was not able to provide all the exact models you requested. I took the liberty of using my own judgment."
He pulled that list out of a back pocket and passed it over. Tucker scanned it and nodded.
"Nicely done. Hopefully we won't need any of it."
"God willing,"
Christopher replied. 1:38 p.m. Tucker stared at the passing landscape as the Cessna droned toward their destination. Buckled opposite Tucker, Kane matched his pose, his nose pressed to the window. The scenery north of Cape Town was hypnotically beautiful, a dry moonscape of reddish-brown earth and savanna, broken up by saw-toothed hills. Tiny settlements dotted the countryside, surrounded by brighter patches of green scrub. At last, Christopher swung the Cessna into a gentle bank that took them over Sprengbok. The town of 9,000 lay nestled in a valley surrounded by rolling granite peaks, called the Kleinkopper Berge, or Small Copper Mountains. The plane leveled out of its banking turn and descended toward Springbok's airstrip. As they landed, the tires kissed the dirt tarmac without the slightest bounce. They rolled to the end of the runway and turned right toward the terminal, administrative offices, and maintenance hangars. Christopher drew the Cessna to a smooth stop alongside a powder-blue Toyota SUV. A man bearing a striking resemblance to Christopher and his brother waved from the driver's seat. Tucker called toward the cockpit.
Another brother, Christopher?
Yes, indeed, Mr. Wayne. This is Paul, my youngest brother. He flew up here last night to arrange things and make inquiries.
When the engines had come to a complete stop, Christopher walked back, opened the side door, and helped them out. A palpable blast of heat struck Tucker in the face. Anya gasped at it.
Bukalov grumbled his displeasure. What is this fresh hell you have brought us to, Tucker?
Christopher laughed.
Do not worry. You will get used to the heat.
He stepped away, embraced his brother Paul, and motioned them into the SUV.
My brother has arranged accommodations at a guest house not far from here.
Why? Bukalov said. How long will we be staying here?
At least a night. Matthew will remain here and guard your supplies. If you climb aboard, please.
Soon they were heading north on a highway marked R355. Barren foothills flanked both sides, their eroded reddish-orange flanks revealing black granite domes.
This place looks like Mars, Bukalov said. I've seen no water at all in this godforsaken land. How are we supposed to find a well out here?
Patience, Doc, Tucker said.
They finally reached the outskirts of Sprengbok. It could have passed for a small town in Arizona, with narrow, winding streets bordered by modest ranch homes. Paul turned into a crescent-shaped driveway lined by thick green hedges. A hand-painted placard atop a post read, Clay Posse Guest House. The SUV stopped beneath a timbered awning. A set of stone steps led up to French doors, bracketed by a pair of potted palms. After speaking to a bellman in white shorts and a crisp polo shirt, Christopher led his charges, including Kane, into the lobby.
Oh, this is glorious, Anya said,
referring more to the air conditioning than the accommodations. Though they were handsome, too. The lobby consisted of leather armchairs, animal hide rugs, sisal runners, and framed drawings of famous African explorers. Above them, huge rattan-bladed ceiling fans hung from exposed beams and churned the already cool air. Christopher checked them in, then led them to a private meeting space down the hall. They gathered around a mahogany table. Sunlight streamed through the tilt of plantation shutters. Sparkling pitchers of water, floating with sliced lemons, awaited them. Paul eventually stepped inside and crossed to the head of the table.
"Mr. Wayne," he said, "Christopher informed me of your interest in a local feature, Greacher's Well. I've been making discreet inquiries, but no such place seems to exist, I'm afraid."
"It must,"
Bukalov snapped, still out of sorts from the travel and heat. Paul said, too gracious to argue.
"However, the relationship between Sprengbok and water is a long and bloody one. Water was quite treasured here and fought over, as you can well imagine with the heat. So natural sources were often hidden. In fact, the town's original Afrikaans name is Sprengbokfontein."
"What does that mean?" Anya asked.
"Sprengbok is a local antelope. If you keep a sharp eye, you will see them hopping about. And fontein means fountain. But a fountain here simply refers to a natural spring or a watering hole."
"Or perhaps a well," Tucker added.
"Exactly so. But man-made wells are relatively modern features here in Sprengbok. Before the middle of the 20th century, locals relied upon fontaines, natural springs. That is why my brother and I believe what you are actually seeking is not a well, but a spring.
But how does this fact help us? Tucker asked. Perhaps much, or perhaps not at all, Christopher replied.
But there is a man who might know that answer. Reverend Manfred Kluter.
The name struck Tucker as familiar. Then he remembered a detail from the briefing back in Istanbul.
Kluter, Tucker said.
That's the name of the family that once owned Melkbashkoil Farm. The one Sprengbach was founded upon.
Christopher nodded.
That's correct. Manfred is indeed descendant from that distinguished lineage, making the man not only Sprengbach's reverend, but the keeper of its unwritten history as well.
Paul checked his watch.
And he's waiting for us now.
2:15 p.m. Crossing through the historic center of Sprengbach, Christopher turned into a paved parking lot surrounded by a low stucco wall and shaded by lush green acacia trees. Nestled within those same walls stood a sturdy stone church, with a single square steeple and a large rosette window in front. It resembled a miniature Norman castle.
Sprengbach's Kipklerk, Christopher declared. The Dutch Reformed Church, now a museum.
He waved his three passengers out. Tucker and Kane clambered from the back seat. Anya slid out the front passenger door. They had left Bukalov back at the guest house. The travel and the sudden heat had proved too much for the Russians' reserves. As a precaution, Paul had been left behind to watch over the doctor. Anya waited for Tucker to join her before following Christopher toward the church. She smiled at him, slightly cradling her casted arm. She must still be in some pain, but she hadn't made a single complaint. Perhaps she feared her injury might be used as an excuse to leave her behind. Either that, or she was a real trooper. Christopher led them along a path that took them to the rear of the church and across a broad, well-manicured lawn. To one side, a barrel-chested man with wild white hair and a bushy beard knelt beside a bed of blooming desert flowers. He wore Bermuda shorts and nothing else. His torso was deeply tanned and covered in curly white hair.
Manfred! Christopher called.
The fellow looked over his shoulder, saw Christopher, and smiled. He stood up and wiped his soiled palms on a towel dangling from the waistband of his shorts. As he joined them, Christopher made the introductions.
Ah, a pair of fellow historians, Manfred Kluter said, shaking their hands.
His light blue eyes twinkled.
Welcome to Sprengbokfontein.
His accent was pure South African, a blend that sounded both British and Australian with a bit of something mysterious thrown in.
I appreciate you seeing us, Reverend, Tucker replied.
Manfred, please. My goodness, is that your hound?
Kane came bounding past, doing a fast circuit of the yard.
He is indeed. Name's Kane.
Might tell him to be careful. Got some snakes about. Can't seem to get rid of them.
Tucker whistled, and Kane sprinted over and sat down.
Follow me, all of you, Manfred said. I've got some lemonade over in the shade.
He led them to a nearby picnic table, and everyone sat down. As Manfred tinkled ice and lemonade into Anya's glass, he asked,
So, Miss Averin.
Anya, please.
Of course, always happy to accommodate a lady's request, especially one with a wounded wing.
He nodded to her cast.
What is this interest in the Boer Wars?
She glanced to Tucker, letting him take the lead. He cleared his throat.
It's my interest, actually, a personal one. I recently discovered one of my ancestors fought during the Second Boer War. He was a doctor. I know very little else about him except that he served most of his time during the fighting at a fort somewhere around here.
If he was a doctor, that would most likely put him at the Klipkoppie Fort. That's where the local medical unit was stationed.
It was under the command of General Mani Rusa. Tough old bird, and a bit crazy, if you ask me. The British hated fighting him. You'll find the ruins of the fort just outside of town.
Tucker frowned. On the flight down here, he had already studied the locations of various old forts, hoping for a clue. Outside of town, he asked. But according to my research, the ruins of Klepkopi are in the center of town.
Pah! That dung heap beside the shopping center? That was only a forward outpost, nothing more. The ruins of the real Klepkopi are 2 miles to the northwest. Christopher knows where.
Then why?
Easier to suck tourists into the gift shops and restaurants if it's in the center of town. Besides, the real Klepkopi isn't much to look at, and it's hard to get to. Can't have tourists getting themselves killed.
He clapped his palms against his thighs.
Right, so, tell me the name of this ancestor of yours.
De Klerk. Paulos de Klerk.
Manfred leaned back, clearly recognizing the name, staring at Tucker with new eyes.
The famous botanist.
You know him.
I do. Though I can't say more than that. I actually forgot until you reminded me just now that he was a field medic. He's much better known for those flower drawings of his.
It's actually one of his journals that drew us down here.
In one of his diaries, he mentioned Greach's Well several times. It seemed important to him.
Water was back then. It was the difference between life and death, especially during the wars. When the Brits laid siege to a Boer fort, one of the first things they did was try to cut off access to water. A man can go weeks without food, but only a few days without water. For that reason, the Boer started building forts atop natural springs. Because of the importance of such water sources, the troops came to name them after loved ones, usually women, wives, daughters, nieces.
Anya stirred.
And Grecha is Afrikaans for Wilma.
Manfred nodded.
Wilma must have been dearly loved by whoever named that spring. But, like I said, the springs of most forts bore women's names. The key is to find out which fort it might be. Because your ancestor was a doctor, I'd still start with the ruins of Klepkopi.
Anya stared out toward the horizon at the dry hills.
Do you know of any wells or springs up there?
No, but if the spring hasn't dried up, there'll be evidence of erosion on the surface from where the waters seasonally rise and fall. Christopher will know what to look for.
Christopher appeared less convinced.
It will be hard to find, and we're still not certain Klepkopi is the right fort. With all the old Boer strongholds around here, it could be like finding a needle in the haystack.
Still, it gives us somewhere to start, Tucker said.
And in the meantime, Manfred said, I will look more deeply into the local history of your ancestor, Paulos de Klerk. Come by tomorrow afternoon, and we'll talk again.
2:55 p.m.
Should we head to the Klepkopi fort now?
Christopher asked, as they pulled out of the parking lot.
How hard is it to reach?
It's not far to the base of the fort's hill, but there are no roads to the top. We must hike. Very steep, but I know the way.
Tucker checked his watch.
When does the sun set here?
Remember, you are south of the equator. It is our late summer, the end of our rainy season. So the sun won't go down until a bit past 7 o'clock.
That gives us roughly 4 hours.
He turned to Anya.
We can drop you back at the guest house on the way out of town, let you rest. I'm not sure your orthopedist would approve of you going hiking.
And miss this chance?
She lifted her bad arm.
It's fine. Besides, I've got my boots on. Might as well use them.
Tucker heard happy thumping on the seat next to him.
Sounds like it's unanimous.
Christopher turned the SUV and headed away from the guest house. He wound through the streets to the edge of Sprengbok, then out into the sun-blasted countryside. They had traveled a couple of kilometers when Christopher's phone rang. Tucker felt a clutch of fear, wondering if they should have checked on Bukalov before setting out. But there was no way the old man could make the hike in this heat. Christopher spoke in hushed tones on the phone, then passed the handset over his shoulder.
It's for you. It's Manfred.
Both surprised and curious, he took the phone.
Hello?
Ah, my good fellow. Glad I was able to reach you.
His words were frosted with excitement and pride.
I did some digging as soon as you left. It seems General Manirusa, your old ancestor's commander, had a daughter named Wilhelmina.
Another version of Wilma.
Quite right. And listen to this. In one of Rusa's field reports, he states, and I quote, without Wilhelmina,
that British bastard MacDonald would have been successful in his siege of our fort. I suspect he's referring to Sir Ian MacDonald, a British regimental commander back then. But I doubt Rusa's young daughter had any hand in breaking that British siege.
He must be referring to the fort's water supply, named after his daughter.
And surely your ancestor would have known of this secret nickname for the well.
Tucker thanked Manfred and hung up. He relayed the information to the others. Christopher smiled.
It seems our haystack has gotten considerably smaller.
Chapter 29. March 19th, 3:22 p.m. Springbok, South Africa. 11 miles outside of Springbok, Christopher turned onto a narrow dirt driveway that ended at a tin-roofed building. The billboard atop it read, Hellman's Garage. Christopher parked in the shadow of the building, then got out and disappeared through an open bay door. When he returned, he opened the passenger side for Anya and waved Tucker and Kane out.
Hellman says we can park our vehicle here. If we are not back in 3 weeks, he says he will alert the police.
3 weeks?
Anya asked, then noted Christopher's smile.
Very funny.
Christopher pulled a trio of day packs from the SUV's trunk and passed them out. He also unzipped a rifle case and handed Tucker a heavy double-barreled gun, along with a cartridge belt holding a dozen bullets, each one larger than his thumb.
Nitro Express cartridges, Christopher said. .470 caliber.
Are you familiar with weapons, Mr. Wayne?
Tucker broke the rifle's breech, checked the action, and gave it a quick inspection. He pulled a pair of nitros from the belt, popped them into the breech, and snapped the weapon closed.
I'll manage, he said.
Very good.
Christopher's expression grew serious.
It is unlikely we will encounter anything, but there are lions in this area. I recommend that Kane stays close to us.
He will.
If we encounter lions, we shall try to back out of the area slowly. Lions are typically inactive during the day and mostly sleep, but if there is a charge, stay behind me. I will take the first shot. If I miss the shots with both barrels, or the lion failed to yield, I will drop to the ground to give you a clear field of fire. The lion will likely stop to maul me. When he does, take your shot. Do not hesitate. This is very important. Aim a few inches below the lion's chin, between the shoulders, if possible, or if from the side, just past the armpit.
Understood, Tucker replied.
And finally, if you miss your shots, do not, under any circumstances, run.
Why not? Asked Anya.
Because then you will die exhausted, and that is no way to present yourself to God.
With that, Christopher prepped his own rifle and donned his pack. He also pulled out a tall walking stick with a tassel of steel bells at the top.
Ready?
He asked.
Hold on, Anya said. Where is my gun?
I am sorry, Mrs. I did not think. I have very few female clients, you see. Plus your wrist. Please forgive me.
It's okay, Christopher. Once one of you two drops from exhaustion, I'll have my rifle.
Anya smiled sweetly.
Which way are we headed?
South, to the trailhead, Mrs. Then northeast into the hills.
Anya turned on her heel and headed off.
Try to keep up, boys.
She led them across a patch of scrubland to where the thin trail headed northeast. From that point, she wisely let Christopher take the lead. Almost immediately, the grade steepened, winding its way higher into the hills. Tucker kept up the rear. He tapped Kane's side. Close roam. As was his habit, Kane trotted to either side, sometimes drifting ahead, sometimes dropping back, but he never strayed more than 50 feet in either direction. The shepherd's ears looked especially erect, his eyes exceptionally bright. Here were smells he'd never before experienced. Tucker imagined it was something of a sensory kaleidoscope for Kane. After a kilometer or so, they passed into a narrow ravine and found themselves in shadows. A riotous profusion of desert flowers and dusky shades of pink and purple bloomed from the rock faces around them, casting out a sweet perfume, not unlike honeysuckle. The deep thrum of insects greeted them as they moved through, amplified by the tight space. Kane stood before the wall of blooms, watching petals and leaves vibrate, his head cocked with curiosity.
"Cape honeybees," Christopher announced. "Fear not. If we do not bother them, they will not bother us."
"There must be thousands,"
Anya murmured. "Many, many thousands, missus."
A quarter of a mile later, they exited the ravine and found themselves on a plain of red soil and scattered scrub brush. To their left, rolling granite hills towered hundreds of feet into the air. Abruptly, Christopher let out a barking yelp. Then another one 30 seconds later. Then one more. In between yelps, he shook his walking stick, tinkling the bells attached to the handle.
"What's he doing?"
Anya whispered back to Tucker. "Letting everyone know we're here. Most wildlife doesn't want anything to do with us." Cocking his head, Christopher stopped. He held up a closed fist and pointed to his ear. "Listen." After a few moments of silence came a deep, huffing grunt. It echoed over the hills and faded. Without a sound, Kane padded to the head of the column, halting several feet in front of Christopher. The shepherd angled his body to the right and sat down, his eyes fixed in the distance. The huffing came again, then stopped.
"Male lions," Christopher said, and pointed off to the left. "A few miles away. They should stay there until nightfall."
Kane continued to stare, but in the opposite direction from where Christopher had been pointing. Tucker dropped to a knee next to his partner.
"Maybe those male lions will," Tucker murmured. "But look beyond that line of scrub trees over there."
"What? I do not see..."
Christopher's words trailed, ending with a whispered, "Oh my." 100 yards away, a trio of lionesses, each well over 300 pounds, slipped from the brush and began slowly stalking toward their group. As if by some unseen cue, the trio parted to change their angle of attack. The largest of the group took the center position.
"This is unusual," Christopher muttered. "They usually do not behave this way."
"Tell them that. They're trying to flank us."
Anya said,
"What should I do?"
"Stay still,"
Christopher said.
"Tucker, if they get around us..."
"I know."
Even as Tucker said the words, Kane stood up. The shepherd arched his back, his fur hackling up in a ridge along his spine, bushing out his tail. He dropped his head low to the ground and bared his fangs. A deep, prolonged snarl rolled from his chest. He began padding toward the lead lioness.
Christopher said, "Tucker, stop him." "He knows what he's doing," he said, putting his faith in Kane. "Follow me. Gun ready. Anya, stay behind us."
"This is ill-advised,"
Christopher whispered. Tucker rose to his feet and followed Kane, pacing carefully but steadily. The center lioness suddenly stopped. A 300-pound mountain of muscle, claw, and teeth. She crouched low, her tail slashing back and forth behind her. The other two also stopped, settling to Tucker's 2 and 10 o'clock positions.
"What's happening?"
Anya whispered. Kane's letting them know we're not an easy meal.
"This is remarkable," Christopher rasped. "Did you teach him this?"
"This isn't teachable," Tucker replied. "This is instinct." The lead lioness began huffing. Kane let out a snapping growl and took 3 fast paces forward. Saliva frothed from his jaws. Tucker murmured, "Hold."
"Let's give our visitors a little nudge," Christopher said. "A single shot each, above their heads."
Tucker nodded.
"You call it. Understand, if they do not bolt, they will charge."
"I'm ready."
Anya said,
"I think I'm going to be sick."
"Swallow it," he warned.
Christopher turned to face the lioness to the left flank. Tucker did the same to the right. Kane stayed put, his gaze fixed to the beast in the center.
"Fire!" Tucker lifted his rifle, propped the butt against his shoulder, and blasted over the lioness's head. She jumped, then dropped low and slunk away, back through the line of scrub bushes. Christopher's did the same as he fired. The big lioness never budged, holding her ground as the others retreated. She stared at Kane for a few more seconds, let out another huffing grunt, then turned and walked after the other two. With a final backward glance, she disappeared from view. Christopher wasted no time in leading them off. After putting a few hundred yards between them and the lionesses, they stopped for a water break under a rock ledge. Kane sat comfortably in the shade, as though nothing unusual had happened. No one spoke for a few minutes. Then Anya said,
"I've never been so terrified in my life. The look in those eyes. We were simply meat to them."
"Essentially, yes," Christopher said.
"I am not even sure I understand what happened."
"Lions are to be feared, but they are not stupid. Given the choice between ambushing easy prey or engaging in a fight, they will always choose the former. It is a simple matter of practicality. An injured lion is a weak lion. Tucker's dog was simply reminding them of that point. Plus, it is just past the main rutting period, so plenty of young animals are around. They have abundant food. If prey had been scarce, our encounter back there would have ended badly."
4:45 p.m. Rehydrated and with nerves calmed, the group headed out again. After another 20 minutes, Christopher stopped and pointed into the hills.
"The ruins of Klepkopi Fort are over that ridge. Now we climb a bit."
"How far?" asked Anya.
1/2 kilometer. As we go, stomp your feet occasionally so we do not surprise any snakes."
Christopher led them up a shallow gully, awash with boulders, scrub brush, and the occasional tree. The trees had wide trunks that narrowed to a cluster of leafless branches that ended in single star-shaped buds.
"It looks like broccoli," Anya said.
"Kokebuum," Christopher called over his shoulder. "Also called quiver trees. The San people use the hollow branches as arrows."
As the gully grew narrower, it eventually required hopping from boulder to boulder to continue the steep ascent. A few spots required Tucker to haul Kane up or assist Anya. Finally, clawing their way up the last few yards, they reached a half-crescent-shaped plateau overlooking Sprengbok. They were all breathing heavily, gulping water, sweating.
"What a view," said Anya,
leaning over the edge. A sheer cliff dropped away at her toes. Behind them climbed a steep-walled granite dome. Across the plateau, the stubbed ends of timbered pillars stuck up out of the ground. More sprouted across the curve of the dome. Squinting his eyes, Tucker could almost make out the bases of old fortifications and the foundations of long-lost buildings.
"This is the Klepkopi," Christopher announced.
"Not much left of it," he said.
"No, time and erosion have done their job. 120 years ago, this was a massive fort. The watchtower sat atop the dome. From here, Boer soldiers could see the entire valley below. The only access was up that narrow ravine we climbed."
"A natural choke point."
"Exactly so."
Tucker began to wander into the ruins, but a shout from Christopher halted him.
"Step carefully. This plateau is riddled with tunnels and old cellars."
"Here?" Anya asked.
"This looks like solid rock."
Tucker knelt and probed the earth with his fingers. "Sandstone. Definitely workable, but it would have taken hard labor and patience to excavate here." Christopher nodded.
"Two qualities the Boers were known for. The entrances are covered by old planks, probably very fragile by now. Below us are sleeping quarters and storage areas."
Tucker called to Kane, who had wandered off to explore.
"Come."
The shepherd galloped over and skidded to a stop. Kneeling, Tucker opened his canteen and filled his cupped hand. He rubbed the water over Kane's snout and under his chin. He held his damp palm to his nose.
"Seek. Easy step."
Nose to the ground, Kane padded off, following the edge of the plateau.
"What's he doing?" asked Anya.
"Setting up a search parameter."
Kane began working inward, crisscrossing the dirt with his nose in the ground. Occasionally, he would stop suddenly and circle left or right before resuming course.
"Tunnel openings," Tucker explained to Anya and Christopher.
"Remarkable," Christopher murmured.
Kane suddenly stopped a quarter of the way across the plateau. He circled one spot, sniffing hard, stirring up dust eddies with his breath. Finally, he lay down and shifted around to face Tucker.
"He smells moisture there."
The trio worked cautiously toward him. Christopher led the way, thumping his walking stick against the ground, testing each step. Once they reached Kane, Tucker gave his partner a two-handed neck massage.
"Atta boy."
Christopher lifted his walking stick and drove the butt of it hard into the dirt at the spot where Kane had been so vigorously sniffing. There came a dull thunk.
"Impressive beast of yours," Christopher said.
Unfolding the small spades in their packs, the trio dug and swept away the packed dirt until a square of planking was exposed. It looked like a trap door into the earth. Luckily, the rough-hewn wood was rotted, desiccated by a century of heat. Jamming their spades into crannies and splits, they slowly pried the planks free and set them aside, exposing a dark shaft, about a yard across. Lying on his belly, Tucker pointed his flashlight down the throat of the tunnel. Kane crouched next to him, panting, sniffing at the hole.
"Looks to drop about 8 feet, he said, rising to his knees. "Then it branches off to the left."
"Who goes first?"
Anya asked. As if understanding her, Kane gained his feet and danced around the hole, his tail whipping fast. He looked up at Tucker, then down at the shaft.
"Take a guess," Tucker said.
"You're sending him down there?"
Anya crossed her arms.
"That seems cruel."
"Cruel? I think Kane was a dachshund in a former life, a breed built to flush badgers out of burrows. If there's a hole, Kane wants to crawl in and explore."
Tucker pulled the shepherd's tactical vest out of his backpack. Anticipating what was to come, Kane shook and trembled with excitement. Tucker quickly suited up his partner, sinking the feed into the new sat phone Harper had supplied. He ran through a quick diagnostics check and found everything working as designed.
"Ready, Kane?"
The shepherd walked to the shaft and placed his front paws on the lip. Tucker played the beam of his flashlight across the sides and down to the floor of the tunnel. He pointed.
"Go."
Without hesitation, Kane leaped into the darkness, followed by a soft thump as he landed at the bottom.
Sound off.
Kane barked once in reply, indicating he was okay. Tucker punched buttons on his phone, and Kane's video feed came online. Shading the screen with his hand to reduce the sun's glare, he was able to make out the horizontal tunnel that angled away from the shaft. The camera had a night vision feature, but Tucker tapped a button and a small LED lamp flared atop the camera stalk, lighting Kane's way. The sharper illumination revealed coarse walls, shored up by heavy timber. Out of the sun and wind, the wood looked solid enough, but looks could be deceptive. Back in Afghanistan, he'd witnessed several tunnel collapses while hunting for Taliban soldiers in their warren of caves. Fearing the same now, he licked his lips, worried for Kane, but they both had a duty here. Speaking into his radio mic, he said,
"Forward. Seek."
Hearing the command, Kane stalks forward. He leaves the glaring brightness of the day and heads into darkness, led by a pool of light cast over his shoulders. His senses fill with dirt and mold, old wood and stone. But through it all, he fixes on a trail of dampness in the air. It stands out against the dryness. He needs no lights to follow it. But he goes slowly, stepping carefully. His ears pick out the scrunch of sand underfoot, the scrabble of chitinous legs on rock, the creak of timber. He pushes through faint webs of dust. He reaches another tunnel, one that crosses his path. "Which way?" A command whispers in his ear. His partner sees what he sees.
"Seek."
He steps to each direction, stretching his nose, breathing deeply, pulling the trail deep inside him, through his flared nostrils, past his tongue, to where instinct judges all. He paces into one tunnel, then another, testing each. Down one path, to the left, the air is heavier with moisture. His ears hear the faintest tink of water falling to stone. He heads toward it, his heart hammering inside him, on the hunt, knowing his target is near. The tunnel drops deeper, then levels. Several cautious paces farther, and the passage opens into a cavern, tall enough to jump and leap with joy within. He wants to do that, but instead he hears,
"Hold,"
and he does. He stares across the sloping floor of the cave, to a pool of glassy blackness. The sweep of his light bathes across the surface, igniting it to a clear azure blue. Water.
"Eureka," Christopher murmured.
Tucker turned to the others and passed Anya his phone.
"I'm going down there. When I reach Kane, I'll check in, using his camera."
He turned, fished through his pack, and pulled out his handheld GPS unit. He stuffed it into a cargo pocket of his pants.
"I don't understand," Anya said. "Why do you have to go down there? It doesn't look safe for someone as big as you."
Tucker scooted to the hole and swung his legs over the edge.
"We need accurate coordinates."
"But why?"
Concern shone on her face.
"We know the well is below this plateau. Isn't that close enough?"
"No. We need a compass bearing from that exact spot. Any miscalculation of the well's location will be compounded exponentially 200 miles away."
He pointed toward the horizon.
"Make a 100-yard mistake here, we could be off by a mile from de Klerk's coordinates. And out in the broken and inhospitable terrain of the Groot Karas Mountains, we could spend months up there and never find it."
Anya looked stunned.
"I didn't think about that."
Tucker smiled.
"All part of the service, ma'am."
He prepared to lower himself down, then stopped.
"Wait,
I just realized I can't get any GPS lock underground.
I'm going to have to go old school.
Christopher, lend me your walking stick." Their guide understood.
"To act as a yardstick. Very clever."
Give me 30 minutes, unless there's a cave-in. If that happens, Christopher said, clapping him on the shoulder, I'll alert the proper authorities to recover your body. And Kane's, too. I want him buried with me. Of course. Anya frowned at them.
That's not funny.
They both turned to her. Neither of them was trying to be humorous. That realization made her go pale. Twisting around, Tucker lowered himself over the edge and dropped below. As his boots hit the ground, he crouched, turned on his flashlight, then ducked into the side tunnel. As he crawled on his hands and knees, he slid the walking stick end to end and counted as he went, mapping his route on a pocket notebook. Occasionally, his back scraped the ceiling, causing mini avalanches of sand. In the confined quiet of the tunnel, the cascade echoed like hail peppering a sidewalk. He reached the intersection of tunnels and followed Kane's path to the left. Working diligently, it still took him an additional 5 minutes to map his way down to the cavern. Kane heard him coming, trotted over, and licked his face. Good boy, good job! Tucker shined his flashlight around the room. Clearly, the Boer troops must have spent a lot of time down here. The surrounding sandstone walls had been carved into benches and rudimentary tables, along with dozens of pigeonhole shelves. Ghosts of men materialized in his mind's eye, laughing, lounging, eating, all during one of the bloodiest and most obscure wars in history. After jotting down the final measurements, Tucker lifted the page of his notebook toward Kane's camera and passed on a thumbs up to the others above. He wanted a visual record of his calculations, of the coordinates of Greach's well, in case anything happened to him. Satisfied with his knowledge secure, he knelt and dipped his fingers into the water. It was cold and smelled fresh. How long had people been using this spring? He pictured ancient tribesmen coming here, seeking a respite from heat and thirst. He decided to do the same. It felt like an oasis, not just from the blazing African sun, but from the pressures of his mission. The events of the past days came rushing back to him, a tumult of escapes, firefights, and death. At the moment, it all seemed surreal. And now I am here, huddled in the bowels of a century-old Boer fort? All because of a plant species almost as old as the earth itself. He looked at Kane.
Can't say our lives are boring, can we? Confirming this, a sharp crack exploded, echoing down to the cave. Tucker's first thought was rifle fire, another lion attack. Then a deeper grumble came, a complaint of rock and sand. He knew the truth. Not a gunshot, a crack of breaking timber. A cave-in was starting.
Chapter 30. March 19th, 5:28 p.m., outside of Springbok, South Africa. Tucker shoved Kane into the tunnel as the rumbling in the earth grew louder, sounding like the approach of a locomotive. Escape! Outside! Kane obeyed the frantic, breathless command and dove out of the cave. The shepherd could move faster, so had a better chance of surviving. No sense both of them dying. Tucker did his best to follow. He abandoned his flashlight, freeing one hand, but he dared not discard Christopher's walking stick. He had failed to measure it before jumping down here. To do his final calculations of the spring's coordinates, he needed the stick's exact length. Ahead, the LED lamp for Kane's camera bobbled deeper down the tunnel, outdistancing him as he scrambled on his hands and knees. Skin ripped from his knuckles as he clenched the walking stick. His knees pounded across rough rocks and hard stone. He'd never make it. He was right. A grinding roar erupted ahead, accompanied a moment later by a thick rolling wash of dust and fine sand through the air. The tunnel had collapsed. Through the silt cloud, Kane's lamp continued to glow, jostling but not seeming to move forward any longer. coughing on the dust, Tucker hurried to his partner's side. Past Kane, a wall of sand, rock, and pieces of broken timber blocked the tunnel. There was no way past. The shepherd clawed and dug at the obstruction. Tucker pushed next to him. With his free hand against the wall, he felt the vibration of the earth. Like a chain of dominoes, more collapses were imminent. With his palm on the wall, his fingertips discovered a corner at the edge of the obstruction. "Hold," he ordered Kane. As the shepherd settled back, Tucker twisted the dog's vest camera to shine the light on his hand, still pressed against the wall. He glanced over his shoulder, then back to his fingers, regaining his bearings. He realized they had reached the intersection of the two tunnels. The collapse had occurred in the passageway to the right, the one leading from the entry shaft to here. What blocked them was the flood of sand and rock that had washed into this intersection by the cave-in. That meant there was no way to get back out the way they'd come in. But, with some luck, they might be able to dig through this loose debris to reach the tunnel on the far side. Of course, there was no guarantee that such a path would lead to freedom, but they had no other choice. "Dig," he ordered Kane. Shoulder to shoulder, they set to work. Kane kicked rocks and pawfuls of sand between his hind legs. Tucker grabbed splintery shards of wood and tossed them back. They slowly but relentlessly burrowed and cleared out the debris. With raw fingers, Tucker rolled away a large chunk of sandstone down the slope of debris. He reached into the new gap and found nothing. He whooped and scrambled faster. He soon had enough of a path for the two of them to belly crawl through the wash of debris and into the far tunnel. Kane shook sand from his coat. Crouched on his hands and knees, Tucker did the same, though his shaking was a combination of relief and residual terror. "Scout ahead," he whispered. Together, they set out into the unknown maze of subterranean tunnels of the old Boer fort, and it was a labyrinth. Passageways and blind chambers met them at every turn. Tucker paused frequently to run his fingertips along the roofs or to shine Kane's lamp up. Distant booms and rumbles marked additional cave-ins. At last, he found himself standing in a square space about the size of a one-car garage. From the carved shelves and the decayed remains of smashed wooden crates, it appeared to be an old cellar. More tunnels led out from this central larder. He bent down and turned Kane's lamp up. He sighed in relief. The low ceiling was held up with wooden planks. As he straightened, Kane growled, a sharp note of fury, then bolted for the nest of crates. He shoved his nose there, then came backpedaling, shaking his head violently. After a few seconds, he trotted back to Tucker's side, something draped from his jaws. Kane dropped it at his feet. It was a 3-foot black snake with a triangular head that hinted at its venomous nature. Only now, past the hammering of his heart, did he hear a low and continuous hissing. As his eyes adjusted, he saw shreds of shadow slithering over the floor, wary of the light. From the other tunnels, more snakes spilled into the chamber. The trembling of the earth was stirring them out of their nests, pushing them upward. Tucker used the butt of the walking stick to push away one from his toes, earning a savage hiss and the baring of long fangs. "Time to get out of here." "Protect," he ordered Kane. He gripped the pole two-handed and slammed the stick upward, striking into the planks with a jangle of the rod's bells. Wood pieces showered down. He kept at it, pounding again and again through the decay and rot above his head, while Kane kept watch on the snakes. He continued to work on the ceiling, trying to force his own cave in, knowing he had to be near the surface. He pictured Kane's earlier cautious search of the plateau, and Christopher tapping the ground as they crossed, watching for pitfalls underfoot. By now, debris had begun to fall faster. Wood, sand, rock. The rain of rubble only served to further piss off the roiling snakes. With his shoulders aching, he smashed the stick into the ceiling again, cracking a thick plank, splitting it in two. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. A good chunk of the roof collapsed, crashing down around Tucker's ears. A piece of wood caught him in the face, ripping a gash. Sand and dirt followed. He did his best to shelter Kane with his body. Then a blinding brilliance. He risked a look up to see blue sky and sunlight as the dome of his dark world broke open. He heard surprised shouts rise outside from Anya and Christopher.
"I'm okay,"
he hollered back. Blowing out his relief, he sank to a knee next to Kane. "We're okay," he whispered. Kane wagged his tail, peacocking a bit, plainly proud of the scatter of dead snakes around him. The sudden sunlight had driven the rest into hiding.
"You're enjoying all this a little too much," Tucker scolded with a smile.
6:13 p.m. In short order, using the nylon ropes in Christopher's pack, Tucker helped evacuate Kane by hooking the rope through the dog's vest. Then he followed, climbing out hand over hand. Once topside, Anya cleaned the gash on his cheek, slathered it with antibacterial ointment, and pasted a bandage over it. Any further ministrations could wait until they reached the hotel. With the sun close to setting, they hurried out of the hills. As the way was mostly downhill, they made quick progress, goaded on by the distant huffing of lions.
"Did you get what you needed?"
Anya asked, marching beside him. Down to the inch. This time, he had measured Christopher's walking stick.
"Good,"
she replied.
"I'm starving, and I've had enough of a nature walk for one day."
He couldn't agree more. Once they reached the SUV parked at Hellman's garage, Christopher headed back toward Sprengbach. It was a quiet, exhausted ride. Christopher called his brother Paul, confirmed all was calm at the guest house, or at least mostly calm. Vukolov had rested enough to become his normal, irascible self, demanding to know everything about the day's discoveries, irritated at being left out. Tucker did not look forward to that. He wanted nothing more than a long, hot soak, followed by a dip in the guest house pool. As they pulled into the parking lot, Christopher's phone rang. He balanced it to his ear as he rolled up to the hotel's steps. Once stopped, he turned to Tucker.
"It's Manfred. He asked if he could speak to you at the church tonight. Says he has some news that might interest you."
He covered the mouthpiece.
"I could put him off until tomorrow."
"I should go," Tucker said, postponing his bath and dip. Anya rebuckled her seatbelt, determined to come too, but he leaned forward and touched her shoulder. "I can handle this," he said. "If you handle Vukolov, someone needs to bring him up to speed or he'll be on the warpath." A look of uncertainty crossed Anya's face. Tucker said, "He'll behave. Just keep it short." Anya nodded.
"After your day, I'll take the bullet with Vukolov."
"Thanks." As Anya disappeared through the French doors, Tucker drove back with Christopher to the church. They found the good reverend lounging where they'd last left him, at the picnic table in the yard. Only now he was fully clothed, all in colonial white, except he remained barefoot. He smoked a pipe, waving it at them as they joined him.
"How went the expedition?" Manfred asked.
"Very well," Tucker responded.
"I believe that bandage on your face says otherwise."
"Knowledge always comes with a price.
And apparently this one was blood."
"You have no idea."
Tucker shifted forward.
"Reverend, Christopher mentioned you had news."
"Ah, yes. Quite mysterious. It seems Sprengbok has suddenly become very popular.
What do you mean?
About an hour ago, I received a call from a genealogist. She was asking about your ancestor, Palos de Klerk.
She, Tucker replied, warning bells jangling inside him. A woman?
Yes, with an accent. Scandinavian, it sounded like.
Felice. Manfred narrowed his eyes. Tucker, I can see from your expression this is not welcome news. At first, I assumed the woman was part of your research team. He shook his head. No.
Competition, then. Someone trying to steal your thunder.
Something like that, he said, hating to lie to a man of the cloth. But can you tell me if this was a local call?
He shook his head. The connection was made through an international operator.
So likely not local.
A small blessing there.
What did you tell her about de Klerk? Tucker asked.
I told her I knew very little. He was a doctor, a botanist, and likely was stationed at Klepkopi.
He bit back a groan, sharing a glance with Christopher. What about me? Tucker asked. Did she inquire about us?
Not a word. And I wouldn't have told her anything anyway. By midway into the conversation, I sensed something awry. I wanted to speak to you before I offered her any further cooperation. That's why I called you.
Did she ask about Grisha's well?
Yes, and I did mention Klepkopi Fort.
This was disastrous.
Sensing his distress, Manfred patted his hand. But I didn't tell her where Klepkopi Fort was.
Surely she'll learn.
She'll learn what you learned, that Klepkopi Fort is located in the center of Sprengbok. It's in all of the tour books.
Tucker remembered Manfred's earlier disdain for the tourist trap. He felt a surge of satisfaction. Such a false trail could buy them even more time. He calmed down. Mostly. Knowing Felice was on her way, he wanted to immediately return to the hotel, haul out his maps, and calculate de Klerk's coordinates to his cave, based on the location of the spring. But he also had a font of local knowledge sitting across from him, and he did not want to waste it. Reverend, you mentioned de Klerk was under the command of General Rusa. In your research, did you encounter any mention of a siege in the Groot Karas Mountains? It was where I believe my ancestor died.
No, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. It wasn't like today's wars, with embedded journalists and cameras and such. But I can look into it.
I'd appreciate it. Manfred stared hard, releasing a long puff of pipe smoke.
From that hunger in your voice, I worry that you're thinking of going up into the Groot Mountains.
And if we are?
Well, if you discount the guerrillas, the Namibian military, the poachers, and the highway bandits, there's always the terrain, the heat, and the scarcity of water, not to mention the indigenous wildlife that would like to eat you.
Tucker grinned. You need to be hired by the Namibian Tourist Board.
If you go, Manfred warned, eyeing him seriously, don't look like a poacher. The Namibian military will shoot first and ask questions later. If rebels or bandits ambush you, fight for your life, because if they get their hands on you, you're done. Finally, take a reliable vehicle. If you break down, you'll never reach civilization on foot.
He nodded, respecting the man's wisdom. Thanks. Tucker stood up and shook Manfred's hand. As he and Christopher headed across the yard, Manfred called after them.
If your competition comes calling, what should I do?
Smile and point her to that tourist trap in the center of town. It wasn't exactly the trap he wished for Felice. That was more of a razor-sharp bear trap. But it would do for now.